This episode is brought to you by Windrose Recovery, a family of premier addiction treatment programs in southeastern Wisconsin. Privately owned, Windrose Recovery offers a full continuum of personalized care for those struggling with addiction, including the Manor for residential treatment, Midwest Detox for inpatient detoxification, and Windrose Counseling for outpatient treatment. With highly personalized treatment focused on trauma, Dr. Chantel Thomas and her expert team offer an authentic experience, creating the kind of deep emotional change that's crucial for long-term recovery. If you or someone you love is struggling with addiction, call Windrose Recovery at 414-409-5300. You can learn more about Windrose Recovery by clicking the link in the show notes or by visiting windroserecovery.com. Thank you for listening to The Path to Authenticity. My name's Tom Gentry. I think of the show as the opposite of small talk. You'll hear real conversations with real people who know who they are. We talk about what makes them who they are, how they became who they are, and how we might become truer expressions of who we are.
I'm April M. Woodard, and this is The Path to Authenticity.
Nowhere to run, nothing to hide from the government's prying eye. Take yourself a summer holiday.
The Path to Authenticity proudly supports the I Speak Media Foundation, advancing media literacy education through an evolving series of outreach programs within the communities that need it most. For more information, visit ispeakmedia.org. Listening. If this is your first time here, thanks for checking it out. If not, thanks for coming back. I'm Tom Gentry, and this is The Path to Authenticity. Episode 105 for January 19th, 2021. Edgar Allan Poe was born on this day in 1809. Paul Cézanne in 1839. On this day in 1861, Georgia seceded from the Union. In 1937, Howard Hughes flew from L.A. to New York in 7 hours and 22 minutes. And in 1981, in Algiers, the United States and Iran signed an accord on a hostage release. So, this episode features an author named April M. Woodard, who writes what she describes as speculative fiction. And when I learned about April, I was really interested in having her on the podcast to talk about her story. She has autism. And so I was just intrigued. She talked to me about how she doesn't take medication of any kind. So I hope you enjoy the conversation. I hope you enjoy the show. And if you do, I'm going to ask that you leave a rating or a review or both on Apple Podcasts, preferably on Apple Podcasts or Podchaser. Those are the two places where it kind of does the most good in terms of spreading the word for the podcast. So a lot of you've done it already, and I appreciate it, but every little bit helps. So anyway, here we go. April M. Woodard.
Government's crying eye. Take yourself a summer holiday.
We're a little little bit behind. We've fumbled around with technology here for the last 20 minutes or so, but here we are, and it sounds good, and I'm happy to have you. So, if I remember right, I encountered you after I did an episode with the author Laura Weissman. I want to say I learned about you around that time. Is that ringing a bell?
Yeah, I think so. A little, yeah.
Yeah, and so
might have been a good while ago.
I've actually had her on twice now. So it was right around as the pandemic was really.
Oh, really? Yeah, that was all blur for me. That 6 months of me recuperating from the initial shock of how I was gonna. Not have a schedule because my kids were home.
Yeah. I mean, it's been such a tumultuous year, but yeah, I remember you followed me and I started following you and paying attention to some of your posts on Instagram and was fascinated when you started to talk about autism and your experience with it and your response to it. And it just made me really want to talk to you right away and hear your story. So I'm happy to have you here. So why don't you tell everybody what you do?
So I'm actually a stay-at-home mom, first and foremost.
How many kids?
So you can call me I have three. I have two boys and a girl, and the two boys are actually on the autism spectrum. They're both considered high functioning. My middle child is a little more on the spectrum, but we've been working with him, so he's been doing really great. So I homeschool him, and then my oldest is in public school, as well as my daughter, who is completely neurotypical. she doesn't have to deal with the everyday struggles that me and my two sons do, but everybody's coming along real good. I think with kids in general, they all have their different personalities, and you just have to kind of mold them in the way that they're already who they are and just kind of work with the gifts they already have. And so, three. And then as I stay home and after homeschooling, I work on my books. So I'm an author. I write speculative fiction, which is a mix of like sci-fi and fantasy. And just basically anything goes. It's alternate reality from what we deal with every day. And it's been really great to put my characters through a lot of situations that I've, approached in real life and never really understood how to deal with it. But using characters has really helped me kind of come out of my shell, because I'm like, well, if my character can do it, maybe I could try it their way.
I love that. That's awesome. It's been a healing experience for you.
It has. Writing has been the main source of therapy for me. So if I'm having like a really rough day or I'm trying to work through something, I'm just like, well, what would my character do? Or what can I put my character through and make them go through a really rough time? And then it makes me feel better about what I'm going through, because apparently what I'm going through really isn't as stressful as what I've put my character through. So it's been very freeing to write feelings down and emotions through fictional characters, even though I'm dealing with certain things. But it's like putting it in a character's point of view. It's kind of like separating my feelings and my thoughts and just kind of putting it away.
Yeah. You're compartmentalizing.
I am.
Yeah. So, I love that. So that's a coping skill that you've developed. Did you get that idea from someone else, like a therapist or author, or did you just figure that out on your own?
I just really figured it out on my own. I have met a lot of other people that struggle with anxiety or depression that have found it very therapeutic. But it was really just, I had an idea for a book from a dream and I wanted to get it down. So I wrote the first draft and then I put it to the side for a couple years and then I picked it back up and I was like, you know what? I really want to tell a story. And so I started my series, The Aeon Chronicles, with three main characters that were all very different and all going through the same situations, but they all kind of dealt with it differently. So my main character is very shy and kind of who I used to be. And then my other characters are very strong and dependent. And so I really enjoyed kind of making characters that I wanted to look up to. So that really kind of, I guess, what brought me into realizing that, oh, this is therapeutic, because not only am I giving my my brain a way to hyper focus and put all that energy into something creative, but I'm also giving my brain a break from whatever had been bothering me that day or the previous day.
So how old were you when you were diagnosed?
I was actually diagnosed when my sons were. So I think my oldest was, I want to say 6, 7. And then it was so funny because the therapist was, he was a child therapist, of course. And he was like, all right, so I'm going to give you a list and we're going to check off all these things that we do for the DSM-5. And I'm like, okay. And so he's like, does your son do this? Does he do that? I'm like, this is starting to sound a lot like all the things I did as a kid. He's like, have you ever been diagnosed? And I'm like, no, but this explains a lot if your diagnosis for him is that he has high functioning autism. And he's like, well, there's your diagnosis. I'm like, okay, now we can move forward. And I literally cried that night after we found out that both my sons had autism and that I had been diagnosed as well, because it was such a relief to have an answer to like what was going on with me, that there was nothing actually wrong with me. I was just, the way I was made was different than neurotypical people. And so it was so much relief. But I also cried for my boys because I knew the struggles, especially in public school, that they would be going through. And it's just really, really hard because your maturity level doesn't match up usually with the people in your grade. But we really have been working through it. And I tell you what, the boys have helped me really figure myself out. And so, yeah, how old was I? I want to say like in my early 30s.
But now you went through stuff as a kid and were you treated for whatever they thought it was, or
what? Yeah. So my parents divorced when I was 5. And so they, of course, assumed, oh, she's just depressed because of the divorce. My dad moved away to Georgia. I lived in Virginia. So there was always we had to travel to Tennessee and meet up and then drive to Georgia. So there's always a back and forth. And then I had to start getting on an airplane when I was like 12, and that was stressful enough being by myself. But, so I was put on, Paxil when I was very young. I want to say probably around the time of 7. I was very young. And then, they just kept upping the dose, and then they would change some different things. And then when I got to be a teenager, oh, it's teenager things. She's just being a teenager. When I finally got on my own, I got off the medication because I knew it was bothering me. And then I had to get back on some because I was in a very stressful relationship with a drug addict. And so they put me on Wellbutrin, and then I started having hallucinations. And so I took myself off that and said, okay, I'm just done with all medication. I got to figure out something for myself. And so it didn't take until I met my husband, who has been like my biggest support group ever, to just help me realize my worth. And then having my kids and realizing I do have a lot of worth because I'm a wonderful mom and I have a lot to give and a lot of good things about me. So it was really a lot of self-realization and understanding that I did have worth and that I didn't need a medication to kind of soothe me or put a Band-Aid on, because that's all it really ever did was, you know, slap a Band-Aid on. And so just really figuring out who I was and being okay with the fact that I have autism was the biggest part, I think, of, you know, just making myself better.
So now they treated you for depression because those two drugs that you mentioned, they're both reuptake inhibitors for the neurotransmitters, the feel good neurotransmitters.
They'd feel good for a little while. And I was also put on Xanax when I was in my early 20s for the time I had my first son. So 21, 22, I was put on Xanax, and this was after the Wellbutrin fiasco. And before that, I was actually diagnosed as bipolar. And I've actually noticed that there are many people on the autism spectrum that are diagnosed as bipolar or manic depressive. And I thought that was really interesting to me because I could see a lot of the same, you know, traits or symptoms or whatever. But honestly, a lot of it too was just being around people, because I'm autistics are usually very hypersensitive to people around them. We have a lot of empathy and we come across as not empathetic, but really we're just trying to sort through all the turmoil inside of, or what we're feeling or seeing, or trying to, I guess, decode everybody else around us to see if it, are these safe people or are they not safe people? Right. I realizing that, you know, I was misdiagnosed was also like a huge relief, because then I figured out, well, you know, I don't need to be medicated for being bipolar. So, there was a lot of medication involved, the majority of my life. And I just felt like finally in my 30s, like I'm really actually starting my life, like actually starting it, not needing to be on anything.
So how long has it been since you have not been treated with anything for your autism?
Since I was 23 or 24, because I had my son around, I think I was 23. That was the year I was 22 was the last time I remember taking Xanax. And that withdrawal was god awful, because I even had shaking fits. The anxiety attacks got worse. Like it was a literal drug withdrawal. It was the worst thing. And
you can die from it. You can die from it.
I still get, I've always had panic and anxiety attacks, but it seems like I still have the tapering off of being on medication, where I'll just wake up in the middle of the night and I'm shaking, uncontrollably. And it's the worst feeling in the world. And so I know a lot of other people that they're not autistic, but they were on medication a lot of their lives, and they still have like all these symptoms of, you know, like, I don't know if it's called drug withdrawal or whatever it is, but just things that linger afterwards that's really affected them.
Well, there's a term, post-acute withdrawal, which, you know, refers to those longer periods beyond, you know, the acute withdrawal is when you have to be tapered and, you know, when you go through the most severe symptoms. And then there's post-acute withdrawal, which, depending on the medication, you have different symptoms. But yeah, I mean, that makes sense, that agitation would be a post-acute withdrawal symptom for a benzodiazepine like that. Mm-hmm. And you know, you talked about being diagnosed bipolar, and now you've met a lot of other people who are on the spectrum who were misdiagnosed as bipolar. In my experience in my career, you know, my perception is that bipolar is overdiagnosed in general, probably less now than it was like 10 or 15 years ago. But now, I mean, a couple of years ago, I work with clients with issues all the time. And sometimes my work brings me to a psychiatrist's office with a client, you know, or I'll have conversations with psychiatrists about clients to kind of give them an overview of what's going on. And I'm really friendly with one who I've been trying to get on the podcast, actually. But there were.
I hope you do.
I will. He's a neurologist too. He's awesome.
Oh, great.
But, you know, there were a couple clients in succession who had been referred to me from a facility where they gave me their diagnostic impression of what was going on with this client. And then I got them to the psychiatrist to manage their medication. And there were a couple in succession, two or three, where from the same facility where they said, you know, we don't really know what's going on, but we think he might be on the spectrum. Right. Mm-hmm. And after a couple times, the psychiatrist was like, well, you know, what the hell is all this bullshit with these people being on the spectrum? You know, he's not on the spectrum. You know, it was really funny. you know, but, and really it speaks to what I really respect most about him as a practitioner is that he's really careful about labeling people or not labeling people. And he's really conservative about how he administers medication to people. Is his,
oh, I really like that.
Yeah. I mean, his go-to is always, let's have you on the least amount of medication that we can possibly have you. Okay. It might be a lot right now, but we're going to work towards having you on very little or nothing if possible. And
right. And there's so many underlining things that could be going on with someone that they, you know, you just don't even know. That's why I went to my therapist and he only got a fraction of what I had been through. I mean, I had been through a lot as a child, like some very unnerving things. So, and so like the post-traumatic stress stuff was littered in there, and then you add my autism to it. So, I mean, of course I had trust issues. And then my dad wasn't really around a lot of my life, but my stepdad was a really big factor in me getting through anything. So I'm very grateful and very blessed that he was in my life. But, it's just a lot of things going on with people. You just never know. And then they're like, well, let's just medicate them and we'll put a Band-Aid on. It'll go away.
Well, and they really, you know, it's Western medicine. I mean, it's really geared towards what's the problem and how do we fix it? You know, and doctors in general, I mean, just the practicality of how our medical care system works is like you go to the doctor to get a prescription. You know, that's where, you know, instead of like taking a holistic view of what is actually happening with you overall as a human being, like what are you eating, are you exercising, you know, there's so many different factors to a person's well-being, you know. Yeah. And emotional well-being affects physical well-being.
Oh, absolutely.
And obviously mental health. So, wow. So
it all works together.
Yeah. So that's, so you learned as a parent who was trying to help her child that you had the same illness that he had. That's what happened. Mm-hmm. What was
and
that
I'm
like?
I'm so glad that I do. Oh man, it was rough. before we knew, I mean, it was just a constant battle. So the first 3 or 4 years, I was stressed out. The kids were stressed out. And so before I had really figured out what was going on with me, I mean, I was yelling. They were screaming and crying. It was really hard. My middle child, who's a little more autistic than my other son, I pulled my sciatic out. I don't know how many times because he constantly wanted to be held because he was upset all the time. And until we were able to really be able to use basic sign language with them, it was just a struggle to communicate. And so that also really helped. So I do want to say to any parents that want to go ahead and try to just the basic stuff to try to work with, like, just baby sign language is so easy to learn. That helped communication exponentially. I mean, I would swear by it. But until that, from year 1 to 3 was just, it was really hard on me emotionally and physically. Not to mention, I've had a health issue, so I wasn't really supposed to be having kids because I have a blood clot disorder, and we later found out I have shingles. So just trying to balance that stuff out and stress. When I'm stressed out, you know, that'll flare up the nerve. So we just decided after the third one not to have any more. But in the process of all that, I think by the time that my oldest was 5 and the other one's 4, so they're only like a year apart, I started realizing, you know, this is not going to be easy, and I'm going to have to try to figure out how, like we did the baby sign language, how to communicate and how to help them in a way that this isn't going to hurt me and it's not going to hurt them. I didn't want to be like my parents. My parents bless my mom's heart. Like she really didn't know any better, and she didn't really know how to deal with a child that had autism, because it wasn't a thing back in the '80s and nineties. And so, you know, that's why she listened to the doctor, medication, also just not understanding how to deal with me and why I was so immature. So me knowing myself, once the boys got diagnosed, I knew, okay, their maturity level is going to be different. I understand that. I understand they're not going to fit in because they're going to like things a little different than people their age. But so once they were around 7 and 8, things got so much better. I actually homeschooled my oldest and my middle child. And then I sent my oldest back to school and they said, I've never seen him do so well. She's like, what did you do? I was like, well, I understand him and he had one-on-one. I said, he just needs a little more time to mature. I said, and he has to have a schedule and you have to explain to him why things are the way they are. Something about, high functioning usually are always questioning why, like, why do I have to do what you say? Right. And that's what would always get my oldest in trouble. He was just very headstrong and he's a born leader. And he's like, you know, I need to know why you expect me to do what you're telling me to do. My way is better. And a lot of the time, honestly, my son's way of doing things was better. And so, he wasn't the type of follow in line. And I really respect that about him. And so I'm like, well, you know, in society, we have to follow certain rules. I was like, your way may be better, but we have to go, you know, with the rules of what, you know, your teachers and the school says you need to do. And so, it took a little work, but, I didn't want to break his spirit. So I'm like, you know, at home, if you have something you're working on, you want to do it your way, it's your project, you do it your way. But if we're doing something as a family that we got to do it our way, or you're at school, you have to do it, you know, as the older people say, you have to do it. So it took a little while, but it really taught me that patience is the biggest thing that you can do with a child on the spectrum, is just to try to understand them and to try to just, I know how hard it can be, but man, patience is the best thing, and to lower your voice. Yelling doesn't help at all. It just terrifies us on the spectrum, and it just makes us even more anxious. And so I've learned that with someone with autism, like quieter voices or quieter sounds, help when they're already in a very anxious situation. And it might not seem anxious to you, but it's making them anxious. So,
yeah. Well, and lowering your voice in general, it's like contagious. Right.
It is. I've noticed that, as soon as I lower my voice almost to a whisper, my children automatically they're a lot quieter. So yeah. It helps me calm down. It helps them calm down.
Yeah. It's a skill that's taught to use to de-escalate people too, you know, to lower your voice.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, man, this has been a wild ride, hasn't it?
It has. I've learned a whole lot about myself just, from my kids. So I don't know what I would have done if they hadn't have been diagnosed, or I hadn't have been so, I don't know, just very willpower in trying to figure out how I could make sure they would basically survive and thrive in life, because I didn't want them to go through what I went through, especially with my sons, like knowing their worth. That was my biggest thing. It was like, I don't ever want them to feel like they don't have a purpose or they won't make a difference just because they seem different than other people.
Right. It's interesting. You know, I'm a dad. I have a 14-year-old son, and I'm someone who's, you know, pretty emotionally literate. I would say probably more so than most guys, and probably most people. But, so I've always been really in tune to what was going on with me when I'm interacting with my son, and, you know, observing when I was triggered and that kind of thing. And just, you know, really experiencing what would come up for me in my interactions with my son. And, you know, unequivocally, he has been my greatest teacher. There's no
kids
doubt
are great
about
like
it.
That.
But I think it makes me happy to hear you say that you've had that experience with your kids, because I think if we approach our kids that way, it makes us better parents.
Oh, absolutely. Better people in
better
general.
People.
It's just,
yeah.
Yeah. Allowing them, because they see things that we don't necessarily see, you know, and I've always been the type of, I think that's like when I was raised, it was like, oh, you do what I tell you to do, not what I, you know, right, not what right. I do. And I just, that would always bother me as a child. And so I vowed, but when I have kids, I'm going to be an example. So if I get called out on my stuff, like I need to recognize that and fix it. And so that's, I think one of the biggest things with my kids is like, if they're telling me, well, mom, you do this, like, you're right. So I need to be a better example for you as an adult. And, you know, yeah, they are. They're great at, you know, spotting things and showing you exactly what you said, triggers. I've noticed that too. And a lot of the things of, oh, this is what sets me off. So how can I work on that and show them, oh, when you get set off, what can we do to calm down?
And what's that about? Why am I getting triggered?
Why? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just been great. It really has. I mean, it's been painful too at times, you know, but it's
absolutely.
But it's it really is such a gift to be a parent. It is. And you know, I just admire my son so much. I do. And you know, the other thing about it is I'm especially at this place in my life right now where I'm questioning the indoctrination that we go through as human beings in a culture, and like, why do I do what I do? You know, like you were talking about with your son at school. Well, this is the way you got to do it because this is the way it's done at school, and you're part of that right now. But it doesn't necessarily mean it's the right way. It doesn't.
Oh, exactly.
And it doesn't. You know. Yeah. And for me, I'm at a place where I'm asking, you know, is this really what I want, or is this serving me? Or if it's not, who is it serving? Right. Why, you know, and I think that question, especially in the pandemic, I feel like it's given us as a country, I think a lot of us who are lucky enough to be able to, not be just completely consumed with how do I survive right now? You know, what am I doing with my life? Who is it serving? Is it really what I want? You know, I really, instead of everybody being caught up in the mania of not being able to live what is a quote unquote normal life, what things were like before, it's an opportunity to have something better. If
it
we
is.
Allow it to be, you know, like I have clients who, you know, they worked in the corporate world their whole entire adult life. And then all of a sudden they're working from home for 6 months and they're not stressed out anymore. And they're better employees.
Oh, it's amazing.
And they're happy, you know, and they're, it's, you know, it's definitely an eye opener. So how many books have you published?
So three so far. I'm working on the fourth to finish the series. And then I plan to work on, some standalones later. I want to get it more into like my personal branding and, I don't know if you saw my Instagram where you found me with, all the talk about autism, but I plan to get back into, talking more about things on that personal level. But just kind of rebranding a little bit. And so just trying to figure out what I want to do over there. But so I have another account that is called a Bookstagram account. So a lot of people that read books know what that is, but, people that don't might not, but, so I usually take pictures of books. So I'm like a product photographer in my spare time as well. But yeah, so almost done with the series, and then I'll be taking a break and just working on, I guess, more of the figuring out what I want to do, and who I am and how I can benefit others. Cause the whole, I think the side of Instagram, the influencer side, is kind of fading out. And like I was telling you earlier, I think people just want more genuine, real people that, like you said, can connect with. They're tired of the fake, you know, Hollywood look. They want more, reality TV, I guess you could say, and people being more real.
Well, yeah. Yeah. I don't know. I've always wanted more of that, you know? and you know, like some of, I was having a conversation with somebody recently about, now I like Instagram a lot, and I see it as like a little bit of a creative outlet for me. I don't use it a ton. I have a personal account. I have an account for the podcast. I use that more to promote the podcast. I don't interact with people a ton, but it's a form of creative expression for me. And I like the medium a lot, the photo and the caption, and I just so much better than like Facebook, you know, because it's more creative. And it's not as intense, you know?
Yeah, it's definitely not as intense.
Yeah. But also,
I think a lot of people are getting away from Facebook.
Yeah. Yeah. But also, it's been a resource for me, like finding you. I mean, I've had so many of my guests are people who I either learned about or connected with on Instagram. A lot.
Yeah, because the hashtags are very helpful in finding people. I really love that about Instagram, where, you know, there is so many creative people on there, but everybody's talking about different things or into different things. And so that's, like I said, I'm in the Bookstagram community. We only talk about books and post books. Mm-hmm. Majority of us anyway. So I don't have to worry about seeing a whole lot of things I don't want to, such as like political stuff or, just things going on in general. If I want an escape, I'm like, oh, let's talk about book characters. I know where I can go.
Yeah.
But yeah. When I'm on there and I'm looking for people to connect with, as far as like autism or moms or whatever, you know, there's a hashtag for that. And so I really appreciate that it is that kind of platform where there's different ways that you can be like a resource or, you know, a voice.
Or connect with a community of people. You know, like I collect vinyl records. I mean, I've always loved music and I've always loved records.
Oh, I do too.
And
I just got into
that. The vinyl community hashtag. That's,
is there really?
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
I'm sold.
You gotta check that out.
I'll have to.
Yeah, and you know, there are people who just post pictures of them posing with a record cover, you know, and a lot of them people who are like doing a recreation of the cover in real life.
Oh, neat.
Yeah. Yeah.
See, that's so fascinating.
Yeah. Yeah. But it's pretty cool. It is. It's a rabbit hole, though, you know, and I'm the type
of
guy, I'm into a lot of stuff. So, you know, I follow some of those people and occasionally I'll post a photo of a record I recently bought or something that I'm listening to that's like one of my favorite records or something like that.
Do you guys thrift? Like, is that the thing? Is like you thrift to find them? Or because I've been into thrifting too. So.
I have, but not for a while. Not for a while.
Okay.
I've gotten some good records that way, but I've also gotten a lot of junk, you know, the thrift thing. You know, I'll just go through a whole big pile of records and, you know, some of the places they're like, okay, they're 7 cents a piece or whatever. And I'll think, what the hell, I'll just buy them. And not really, if it's something I might enjoy, even if it's something I wouldn't listen to, I might still buy it. But I've also found some stuff in pretty good condition, and I've found, you know what I started to get into, and I've never been that much of a country guy, but really old country records that I found.
Are you serious? Okay, stores. Well, you'd have to talk to my husband because he's a big old school country boy, the Willie Nelson. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I'm talking like there's a guy named Webb Pierce, Hank Snow, Buck Owens, like a little bit.
He probably knows those.
Pre-outlaw country. Willie was outlaw country and then pre-outlaw country, you know, but yeah, no, I mean, it's just been something to, you know, to do. And now, I live in West Palm Beach. There was one really good record store relatively close by, used record store, that's everything was in really good condition. But more recently, there's another one that opened that sells new and used, and they just have they just have everything I like. You know, I mean, jazz, blues, you name it. If there's a band that I like that I think of, you know, if I go to that section, they end up having a record or two. And it just, so I really like going there. It's a husband and wife who I'm actually have been working on getting on here. He's an attorney who's trying to not be an attorney anymore. And just have a record store. And, so I'm going to get them on here before too long too, but yeah.
That would be so great. Yeah. Cause that's really becoming popular again, is this whole like vintage thing, you know?
Yeah. Well, I don't know. We're probably relatively close in age if you grew up in the '80s. but you know, I used to buy records before they stopped making records. And I remember being pissed as a middle schooler when they did stop making records. And, you know, a lot of my friends bought cassettes anyway before that. And then, you know, I kind of begrudgingly switched to cassettes for a while until CDs became prominent. But I always liked the cover, the artwork, the flipping sides, you know, the sequencing of songs, all that stuff. I mean, I love music and I love that aspect of it. Like an artist creating a record in that format, side one, side two, you know, it's just cool. It really is.
It is cool. Yeah, and it really is.
CDs became a little better with the artwork and stuff, but it's not like vinyl. I mean, you know, and now I'm to a point where the stuff I listen to, it all comes out on vinyl. You know, usually they release it electronically on Spotify or Apple, all those, but you know, if you order vinyl, you might get a couple extra songs that aren't released anywhere else. And I always, and usually there's a download code that comes with it. So I always get the vinyl record now, almost, unless it's just somebody who, sometimes the newer artists, they can't really afford to press records. So they're only digital until they get ahead of steam behind them. But yeah, I could totally nerd out on music with you for a long time. I really love it.
I hear you.
Yeah.
I did too.
What's the last concert you went to?
Oh, man. I never really got to go to concerts. Honestly, I was in youth group, and so the last concert I ever went to was Carmen.
Carmen. I don't even know if I know the name. I know I should know who that is, but
yeah,
I'm sure you know
the name. Yeah. So that was the last concert I never really got to go to any like really cool concerts. I really wanted to go see Green Day. I remember when I was younger, that was like,
I never really wanted to see them. I never did see them, but after high school was when all the grungy stuff was happening. So I regret not seeing Nirvana. I didn't do that. I wish I could have. Yeah. And I've seen Pearl Jam a couple times, but you know, like Alice in Chains and all those Seattle bands. I saw at Lollapalooza, did that whole thing a couple times, But yeah, no, I love concerts. I do. It's, you know, music just adds so much color to life, I think.
Oh, it really does. And that's something people don't realize about me. They're like, oh, you like to stay home. You don't like, you're an introvert, aren't you? I'm like, not really. It just depends. But like concerts, because I can feel the music through the bass and everything, really makes a difference. So I'll even sit in my car if I'm like putting a song on repeat for like a scene that I'm thinking of. Like I'll have the, I'll make sure the bass, and people, I'm sure my neighbors are like, what is she doing? Why is she in her car again? It's because I can feel like the actual music. So that's really big for me. And like, what is it called? The 8D or whatever, where you can hear it a certain way in your earphone. I'm really big on that too. So yeah, music is like I have to have music when I'm writing. Or if I need just like a chill out day. But yeah, I am huge on music. Well, actually, you were talking about vinyl records. One of my favorite artists, Sleeping at Last, he has vinyl available. And so I've been trying to like get all his vinyl.
Yeah. Who is it now?
Sleeping at Last.
Sleeping at Last.
Ryan, I want to say, is it O'Neill? So he's an individual artist. He does a lot of piano. He's done stuff for like Grey's Anatomy and, he's like a solo, artist, but I mean, he's done stuff with other people, but yeah, I mean, his music is just very like soul searching kind of stuff. And so Saturn is my absolute all time favorite from his, so it's just really, really good. So yeah, you should check him out. He is like my favorite.
So are you now, just to kind of clarify, you, when you finish this series of books, are you saying that you're going to kind of do some nonfiction stuff, like maybe memoir sort of? Is that what we're talking about?
I've had a lot of people ask me to do that though. I kind of want to wait till my boys are older, like maybe even like adult, like at least in their 20s. So I can ask them questions, be like, what did I do? Like, is there anything that I did differently that, you know, or impacted you the most or something, you know, like to really kind of get interviews.
Yeah,
because I don't want it to be one sided. And, so like I had thought about, oh, a parenting book would be great for, you know, parents that might not be on the spectrum. So they don't understand what it feels like to, be on the spectrum. I mean, it's so different. I think my poor parents, like they just knew, they didn't understand what it felt like the internal turmoil. Just if like, oh, we have a date that we're going to go do something, like to see a movie or something. Oh, well, we have to change the date. It's like so hard on an autistic child to change anything. It's like the end of the world, because they've built themselves up for this exciting day. And then, okay, we're not going to go do it. Even though we're going to eventually do it, it's not on the day that you'd built yourself up for. So yeah, that was one of the things that I learned about my boys, is I had to be like, okay, how can we get around this disappointment? And it's still hard, but trying to figure out how they can deal with life disappointments in general, you know, it's not just little things, but big things are going to come along too. So.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure you keep journals too, right?
I used to, when I started writing my books, it just seemed like that was my alternative therapy session. I had like 4 journals and I burned them all.
Oh my gosh.
I was like, I really wish I hadn't though now. 'Cause I'm like, I wonder what all I went through on this day and that day. 'Cause I really have a very vague memory, of some of the really tough stuff. I don't know if I just like block it out for my, you know, subconsciously or what, but, I burned them all after my first really big relationship. I was like, all right, you're going bye-bye. I mean, that was really hard. And he had actually been diagnosed as bipolar, but I don't know, but he has a lot of traits. I still talk to him, actually, a lot of traits of being autistic. He's very musically inclined, and he goes through his highs and lows. And we just like hit it off right away. And I think it was because we kind of understood, like, we see the world a lot differently as far as, like you were saying, like deep, meaningful conversations. We would sit for hours and have like conversations about life and not just gossip that was going on at school. Mm-hmm. And that's what really drew me to him in the first place. But we're really good friends now. But yeah, it was after that whole thing that I was just like, we're done doing journals.
Yeah, well, I've practically everything I've ever written in my entire life. I've never gotten rid of anything.
Oh, wow. That's amazing. So you would have a really good memoir.
Well, that's part of the reason why I've kept everything. You know, I treat it as like reference material. You know, I have years of journals.
That's so great.
Yeah. And there are things too that I have that I want to write, but I won't write until certain things change in life. You know what I mean? Like, like things I'd want to write about my childhood and stuff, but it wouldn't, you know, I don't really want to write until later.
There's just, you know, certain family members and stuff you don't want to go there with. And, there's a lot of skeletons we've shoved in the closet over the years that, you know, that family members are aware of, but we don't really talk about it. So, I totally understand that. But I mean, it is a really good learning experience for people. Like, eventually it would be, you know,
well, that there's a difference really between writing and publishing. You know, you can still write all this stuff.
Exactly.
You know,
exactly. Yeah. Working through it. You know, that's what I was telling you about the post-traumatic stress stuff is, you know, I worked through it and I could, you know, if I'm close to someone and they've opened up to me, I can explain, you know, this is how you can try to work past some of it, but it doesn't mean it's ever going to go away or you're ever going to forget about it. But this is how you can start healing. And because some of that stuff that, you know, is the stuff people don't talk about is the scars, but it, you know, they'll always be there as a reminder. However, you don't have to, you know, it's not forever that, you're past it, but it is hard to get through all those things. So, but I totally understand the family
in writing.
Thing.
Yeah. But one of the things I love about writing, just like you, healing through your characters, you know, if I'm writing about something, I usually often draw a conclusion that I wouldn't have if I wasn't sitting with pen and paper writing about it. My brain goes into different places and, you know, I learn from it about myself, which I love, you know? So anyway.
Yeah, that's the same for me. Definitely what, and you know, I think because I enjoy doing it through character so much is because it doesn't feel like I'm putting myself back through it. I actually have a friend who has a lot of PTSD because she was actually in foster care a long time and a lot of things happened there. But I said, why don't you just write it as a character and put your character through it? And so it's not so close to you. And she said, oh, I never thought about that. And she came back to me later. She's like, man, like looking at it from the outside that somebody else is going through, I feel like I can help them, you know, but I'm really helping myself.
Well, and we're so hard on ourselves. If we think of it
that
way, we can be more compassionate.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
To ourselves if we look at it from a different perspective. But, you know, one of the things I love, and I've never been much of a fiction writer, I've always been more, like I've done a lot of reporting and, you know, nonfiction stuff. And I like memoir and personal essays and all that. But I took a creative, you know, I've had a fair number of creative writing classes. And once I took a workshop class where, you know, I mean, you write and then you read it and go over it with a room full of people. And, and it was... It was just an assignment to do a dialogue between two people. Nothing else, just the words that they say to each other. A conversation.
Oh, nice.
And I'd never done anything like that before. And when I just started to play with it. And at first it felt really awkward. Hey, how are you? You know, or what? But the next thing you know, I have two characters who are, you know, having a consequential conversation with each other that just came from nowhere. And it channeled through me on, you know what I mean? It was a spiritual experience.
Oh, it is. It's really insane how you can make this dialogue, and you're like, oh, wow. So we went there with it, you know, and you're like, oh.
Yeah. And I don't know if people who don't write think of it that way. I mean, I think people probably think of it more like it's a product of an imagination, which of course it is, but it's also a channeling type of. It happens. You're the one there recording it. That's what it's more like, right?
It is. Mm-hmm.
Isn't that cool?
It's so cool. Well, and I always see everything as like a, that's another thing about autism is, and people are always surprised by this, but Temple Grandin always said that she sees everything in pictures. Well, I see everything as like a movie screen. And so when I go through everything, I'm literally like directing, and I'm seeing everything is like, okay, the camera angle is here. We're focusing on the eyes here, or this is what they're saying, but what are the emotions portraying as well? And so, that's how I really kind of work through, facial expressions. Cause you know, I can kind of understand facial expressions, but you know, if someone's frowning, I'm like, are they frowning in disapproval or disappointment, or they frowning because like they feel bad? Is it like they feel bad for me, or they feel bad for themselves? Like there's a lot of like questions that always go through my head when I'm trying to like overanalyze someone's expression if they're not saying anything. And so yeah, that the conversations that you know you can kind of make your characters go through also is, you know, okay, so if someone's saying this, oh, maybe this is what they mean. That's something else that really helps out. But yeah, it is. It is just, you feel, it gives you a little more like empowerment too, because you feel like, you know, you're kind of working, like I said before, you're working things out, and you're creating something.
It's invigorating.
Especially with storytelling.
It is. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I could talk to you for a long time. So, but, you know, at some point, this thing has to come to an end here. So, you know, obviously, you've been through some stuff in your life. Looking back on it all, was there a time when April needed a word of advice or some direction, support? When did she need it most? And what would you go back and say to her?
Well, if I was getting really, really personal, there was a point in my life where, you know, there's a lot of people that get really, really down. They feel like there's no other option. And so I would have told myself back then that, I was worthy of being loved and that I had something to offer, the world. And just, even if it wasn't to the world, that I did matter, in general, as just a person. And so I would have told myself to just be brave and face it and just keep moving forward. And I did, but there was a lot of years where I wish I had really believed it. Like I told myself that, but I didn't believe it until much further on in life. And so, yeah, I would have just walked in there and be like, hey, it gets better and you have a lot to look forward to. You know, a lot of times we just think that we, you know, nothing's ever going to get better when there's a chance that if we just keep taking those baby steps that, you know, we will get better.
Yeah. And belief is a powerful thing, isn't it?
It absolutely is.
And our beliefs determine so much of how our lives play out. And just the process of evaluating, you know, what are the beliefs underneath these behaviors here? That's really, really empowering and a big catalyst to change if you're willing to be that introspective, you know, it's awesome.
Mm-hmm. So,
well, I appreciate you doing this. This has been great. And I hope you will keep me posted with your publications.
Absolutely.
Come back sometime. And next time you have a book coming out, that'd be great.
No, I would love to talk anytime. I've really enjoyed this. Like you and I were saying earlier, you know, we don't do small talk too much.
No,
it's like really good to get down. And
yeah. Yeah. I just, you know, I think, when I really decided to do this, you know, I realized that, I mean, I was just really, this is the way I wanted to do it. You know, like I had people tell me, well, you don't really want to have a podcast that's any longer than 25 minutes. And in my head, I'm like, hey, yeah, I do. Yeah, I do. You know, well, nobody's going to listen to that. Well, the people who, my people will listen to it. Right.
They will.
And I really have stayed true to that. Yeah. I've stayed true to that vision and trusted it. And I'm glad I have, because, you know, it's been really, really fun. And I've gotten to meet a lot of cool people like you. So. Well, thank you, April. I really appreciate it. And
look forward to sharing. No, thank you for having me.
All right, April M. Woodard. She's somebody who I've been messaging back and forth for months at this point, trying to get her on the show, and we finally got it together. So, appreciate her time. So, January 19th, 2021, worried about this country, as I'm sure a lot of you are, and I hope by tomorrow things will be a little bit more settled. God help us. So, please subscribe, like, follow, leave a rating, review, whatever. Can find the show on Amazon, Apple Podcasts, Breaker, Google Podcasts, Listen Notes, Overcast, Pandora, Patreon, Podbay, Podcast Attic, Podchaser, Radio Public, Spotify, Stitcher, YouTube, or you can just listen on the website at thepathtoauthenticity.com. If you know someone who would enjoy a particular episode, please share it with them. If you have questions or comments, you can call and leave a voicemail at 561-247-4757. I'd love to hear from you. Never know. Might even play the sound on an episode. But I really do want to interact with you guys out there. As I mentioned a few episodes ago, to me, this has always been about creating a community, and I do sincerely want to connect with you. So, thepathtoauthenticity@gmail.com, or again, you can call and leave a voicemail, 561-247-4757. For early access to the newest episode, as well as unedited interviews, you can support the show on Patreon for right now for as little as $1 a month. Just a reminder, the artwork for episode 100 by Heather Sundquist Hall is available in a couple different sizes. A portion of the proceeds will go to iSpeak Media. Visit goldenhourprints.com, or you can click the link in the show notes. Thank you to, again, April M. Woodard. And I want to thank Punk Rock Opera, the band whose music you hear throughout the show. Those songs are used with permission from the artist under a Creative Commons license. I want to thank you to our sponsors, The Manor and Windrose Recovery. Thank you to Wendy Chin at Equivox. And The Path to Authenticity is proud to support the iSpeak Media Foundation. You can learn more about them by clicking the link in the show notes. Again, find us at thepathtoauthenticity.com. There you can find the blog post 20 questions for April M. Woodard. And at this point, most of the guests have finished that questionnaire, which is something that I really like, and I hope it's something you guys like too. Like us on Facebook, follow us on Instagram, both at The Path to Authenticity. You can find the Sunday playlist on Spotify. Just updated that. So, all those things I just mentioned, have links in the show notes for all of them. Also, we're on YouTube, Pinterest, all over the place. Anyway, hope you guys enjoyed this. Say a prayer for this country. Because, you know, this crazy-ass president we've had is part of the inspiration for why I always end each episode with these two words. Be nice. To Authenticity is powered by Equivox. For digital marketing and web design services, visit equivox.com.